Good morning, members, and welcome to the March 11th committee meeting of the House Commerce and Finance Policy Committee. Our first order of business, we do have a quorum. Just a little bit of housekeeping. The Attorney General's Office did deliver to us hard copies of their presentation today. And for those in the public that are listening, we are, if it hasn't been uploaded, we are attempting to get those uploaded to the Commerce website for your use as well. We believe transparency is important. And there will also be on the screens here in the committee room the presentation as well. Next order of business is to approve the minutes from the March 6th committee meeting. And Representative Finke, you looked at me first. Have you had a chance to review the minutes?
These minutes are fabulous, and I move them.
All right. Representative Finke moves the minutes from March 6th.
Mr. Chair, excuse me. There is a minor typo on my name.
Okay. Could you cite that, Representative Ryer?
Yeah. Down in the Representative Ryer, move the minutes there. It's R-E-Y-E-R. Thank you.
That's correct. Representative Ryer, I've been advised that we did that just to see if you were paying attention. And apparently you were. So what we will do without any objections, we'll incorporate that change from the March 5th minutes to the March 6th. All right, with that, and Representative Finke has moved the minutes, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, the motion prevails, and we are on to our primary order of business today. Members, we are probably going to go till about 9:25, 9:30 or so this morning with the presentation from the Attorney General's office. It is my plan and hope that they will spend about 15 minutes maybe going through their presentation and setting it up, and then we would have member interaction. But we'll just talk with the Attorney General's office. They want to go section by section in the minutes, since we did not have a chance really to pre-plan that part of the conversation with them. And so with that, I'm going to ask the Attorney General, Keith Ellison, and I do believe we also have Deputy Attorney Jessica Whitney with us as well to approach a testifying table. And welcome and good morning, Attorney General and Deputy Attorney General.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, members. Good morning, ranking member.
So go ahead and identify yourself for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
So my name is Keith Ellison, and I'm the Attorney General for the state of Minnesota. And it's really an honor to be here. I can tell you that our consumer protection work is work that we are extremely proud of. And the opportunity to talk to you about it is really, really a pleasure. So thank you for inviting me here today. I'm always proud to testify in front of this committee to share more about the amazing work that is happening in the office of the Attorney General's office and ways that we are helping Minnesotans every single day. A first overview of the AG's office, what we do, the role in state government, as the state of Minnesota's chief legal officer and the attorney general, we have four essential lines of business. First, the attorney general represents more than 100 state agencies, boards, commissions in litigation and in other legal matters. Second, the attorney general plays an important role in criminal prosecution, both in supporting county attorneys with criminal prosecution and appeals on their request, and in sharing original jurisdiction over Medicaid fraud with the federal government. Third, the Attorney General serves as on several state boards, including the Executive Committee, the State Board of Investment, the Board of Pardons. And fourth, the main thing we are here to talk about today, the Attorney General's office is the chief enforcer of the state of Minnesota's consumer protection, antitrust, and charities laws. So that's a lot to take in. So I'll just sum it up this way. The job of my office and the job that I do every day is to be the people's lawyer and to help Minnesotans afford their lives and live with dignity, safety, and respect. So affording your life can mean and can feel harder every single day, more than ever nowadays it feels like, in a time when there are so many forces working to separate people from their hard-earned dollars. In 2023, consumers reported losing nearly $10 billion to fraud. Imposter claims were the most common type of fraud Minnesotans reported to the FTC in 2023, Federal Trade Commission. Consumer losses facilitated by social media totaled $1.4 billion in 2023, the highest of any contact method. And people in the age range of 30 to 39 are the most likely victims of fraud, which may be somewhat surprising, while people ages 60 to 69 lose the most money to fraud because they tend to have more of it.
Mr. Attorney General, I hate to interrupt, but I did want to take care of one quick housekeeping item. You have several sections in here. Did you want to go section by section with questions, or you want to wait till the end on your overall questions?
Your choice, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, if you're okay, we'll just take them as we roll,
yeah.
And there may be some free discussion.
Yeah, I'll just pick back up where I left off.
Okay.
So you got questions now?
I do. That's why I asked.
Go for it.
Can you explain why we're seeing that larger amount of fraud in the 30s versus the 60s and 50s and 60s? We always hear the additional consumer protection. A lot of our laws have additional times for rescinding contracts or free look periods and insurance contracts and the like for persons in that age. I'm going to assume that it has to do with internet fraud, but I'm going to let you go ahead and speak to the matter.
Yeah, and let me introduce all of you to Jessica Whitney, who is our deputy of the consumer protection area. She's the co-deputy, and she shares the role with James Cannaday. I'd like you all to give me permission to have her come in as needed. But the likelihood that the younger cohort is often more targeted by fraud is that they're online more. They're often just out there in the world more. Seniors are often targeted, whereas a younger cohort may reach out looking for deals of some kind and has much more internet interaction online. The older cohort simply has more money as a statistical matter, and so often they lose more. And their targets are different kind of scams. You know, the older cohort may have, we've seen grandparent scams. We've seen romance scams. We've seen scammers are clever people. But would you like to augment that?
Yeah, you know, honestly, it's
Ms. Whitney. Oh, go ahead.
Sorry. Honestly, it's been this way for decades. This it's usually people in their 20s. This 30s cohort is actually new, and I attribute it to just people being young, naive, as not as experienced with the world. And so that's actually not a new stat. The new stat is it's moved into the 30s, where it used to be in the 20s. The devastation that fraud wrought is with the older folks, because it takes their life savings out. I mean, they often lose all their retirement, whereas young people lose a lot less money. So I've attributed, yes, to internet, and perhaps that's why the 30-39 as opposed to 20-29, but also just inexperience with the world and trust, more trust.
Deputy Attorney Whitney, One follow-up. I mean, you said that it used to be in the 20s, now it's in the 30s. Are you seeing that same cohort move through? Like in that last 10 years, they were in their 20, 29, and now they're 30, 39, and that group in particular is being exposed more to fraud and to activity?
It goes back even farther than that. I mean, I think that's right, but I think for the last 20, 30 years that the FTC has kept this stat, you've seen it in that younger cohort, the 20 to 29. So I don't know that it necessarily has followed them, although clearly it did in the last couple of years. But like 20 years ago, I believe it would have still been 20 to 29. So does that make sense that it is, again, is that youth? And I think maybe you're right with the internet heavy focused on maybe that millennial group of 30 to 39.
Thank you for the clarification. Lead Her has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe whichever person might be the best to answer this question, but we are seeing that with some of these imposter scams, it's getting more and more savvy. And maybe you're going to get into this later in the presentation, but I was just curious as to like the success of identifying these people and actually taking action. I will say that I am not in the statistics maybe of what you just read, because I'm 51 and I got scammed. And I'm very aware and I'm very savvy of this world, but people are just so much smarter now. Like I know this is getting a little bit long into this, but I actually had a neighbor who lives next door to me who passed away. And somehow the scammers know, like, they're targeting situations in which, like, somehow they're getting into these accounts, and then they're posting things like, we're selling all of these things because, and it's, and even though they're not using all the right language, something seems a little off. It also doesn't make you think, oh, this is out of the ordinary, because somebody passed away, you thinking they're selling off some of these large equipment items that they, and so I was like, okay, well, I'll buy the washer and dryer. And it was like $400, and I'm, and it felt suspicious, but I was like, this is my neighbor Janet. Like, of, you know, I should help her out. And so I Venmo her $400 and try to get these washer and dryer, and it turns out her account had been hacked. And I just thought how savvy they are to be able to identify real life situations in which it would seem plausible that their scam would fall into this like thing. And so I never got back my $400, and Janet eventually recovered her account. But like even most times, like especially an older person, they don't even know their account has been hacked. And so I was just curious as to, in these types of scams, are there, you know, like what's our success rate in identifying who's doing it and then taking action? Because I'm sure if they did it to me, they probably did it to a whole bunch of other people too, right? So.
Jessica.
Representative Hurd, did you want them to respond to that, or is that just an
unless if they're going to go through later on, like, the you know, the recovery process or the lawsuits, that, and then I can wait and hold off until then.
We have a lot more to share.
Okay, yeah, if that question can, is on your agenda, we'll take it at that time. If not, we'll defer to you right now, Mr. Attorney General.
Yeah, we're going to get into it, okay. But I will say that these people are highly sophisticated, work on this all day long, build up years of experience doing it. Some of them aren't in the United States, but they are. This is what they do all the time. Like, so, and they're pretty good at it, and they're pretty nimble at it. So,
Mr. Chair, if you could give me back my $400, that'd be great.
Well, if I may, Mr. Chair, we are a complaint-driven system. We don't just call and say, have you been scammed? Have you been scammed? We don't audit.
Yeah.
We respond to complaints. And so I'd like the record to reflect that you can call 651-296-3353, and we'll be more than happy to take your complaint. And you can complain online, and you can upload any documents or pictures that you think will be helpful.
It just occurs to me that if you do report online, you may be subject to yet a different scam, but for the record. Representative Dotseth has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for being here as well. Question I would have, it kind of tags in with that, is how many, do you have any statistics that indicate how many people do not report being scammed? And if so, is there an age group that chooses not to report versus another age group?
Attorney General, Deputy Attorney.
Thank you, Jessica.
No, that's something I've wanted forever. You've hit the nose on the head. We think fraud is sorely underreported, and it's just estimates that, you know, maybe only a quarter of fraud is reported, and that's even just an estimate, because people like the representative just say, I'm out $400, my bad, and don't report it, and we have no idea. So we think all these numbers are low.
If I may, Mr. Chair, one thing I will commend the representative for talking about this, because what really is at work a lot of times, Representative, is shame. People embarrassed. How could I be so dumb? How could I let these people take advantage of me like this? And they don't want to talk about it at all. And the scammers know that about people, and some people don't report. It's why a lot of people were caught up in the foreclosure crisis. I can't remember. This is back in 2008. How many people would just say, well, why didn't you call sooner? And they're like, I just was so ashamed. It got to a crisis. I realized I couldn't handle it, and so I called you guys. Well, we try to get people to call earlier rather than later because, as you might guess, as time goes by, the trail gets colder.
Seeing no other questions, thank you for the opportunity, and we'll have you go continue with your presentation, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So the attorney generals are uniquely placed to keep consumers safe. Across all 50 states, attorneys general have broad civil authority in state, federal, and common law to protect consumers and advance economic opportunity. These powers date back to the 13th century. The attorney generals, as an institution, did jump over the Atlantic Ocean, and now we have it here in all 50 states and in all the territories. But it is something that dates back to European days. Today, the consumer protection section in my office is the primary public law enforcement arm of the Minnesota's consumer protection laws. The section is overseen by two deputies, as I already mentioned to you, Jessica and Mr. Kennedy, and it's split up into eight divisions, which you can see listed on the screen. Our consumer action division is our main point of contact. That's the number that I just shared with you. If you call that number, somebody from the consumer action division is going to pick up the phone. The consumer action group is comprised of non-attorney staff who answer calls, correspondence, online complaints from people, businesses, and organizations. Consumer action staff are often able to answer questions and provide information over the phone, talk through consumer-related problems, and assist people in locating other government agencies that may be able to address their concerns. The Minnesotans are keeping us busy. In 2024, the division fielded 59,017 calls and spent about 5,984 hours. That's 249 full days serving the public. The most common calls include healthcare, housing, credit reports, debt collection, utilities, and transportation. But actually, the list is much longer even than that. The Consumer Action Division also helps Minnesota residents resolve thousands of complaints with businesses and organizations each year. In 2024, the division handled more than 18,000 cases, up 20% from the last fiscal year, and arrived at settlements in more than 14 million for Minnesota consumers, up more than 50% from the last year. Not only does the division put money back in the consumers' pockets, it often eliminates the need for costly, time-consuming litigation. Moving on, the Consumer Protection Division enforces Minnesota's laws prohibiting consumer fraud, deceptive trade practices, false advertising, and other unlawful practices in business, commerce, and trade. The division also participates in numerous coordinated investigations with multiple state and federal enforcers of consumer protection, including other state attorneys general, the Federal Trade Commission, the Federal Department of Justice, and the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Among its other duties, the division is focused on enforcing new consumer protection laws the legislature enacted in 2024, including laws around price transparency and junk fees, deceptive vaping products designed to appeal to minors, and consumer data privacy rights. Additionally, this division is vital to the passage of the Debt Fairness Act. I want to thank you in particular, Representative Ryer, which makes numerous important reforms to our medical debt, judgment collection, bankruptcy systems, including banning medical debt from being reported to credit bureaus and prohibiting prohibiting providers from withholding medically necessary care due to unpaid debt. The Consumer Protection Division has also been at the forefront of fighting the opioid epidemic. As the epidemic ravaged Minnesota and every state, the division took on companies who were pushing these drugs on our communities, even though they knew full well how dangerous that they were. And I want to thank many members of the legislature who've been instrumental in that fight. Over the past several years, we've landed historic financial settlements with opioid manufacturers, distributors, pharmacies that are bringing in a total of $565 million to the state over 18 years, with much of the money being front-loaded. Although no amount of money can ever make up for death and devastation these companies have caused, it is still important to hold them accountable. And again, representatives like Dave Baker have been very helpful in helping us understand the situation. But winning those settlements was only half the battle. We also had to decide where the money should go. So my office convened state, county, and municipal officials to work out a memorandum of understanding that sends 75% of all opioid settlement funds directly to cities and counties to maximize the dollars which Minnesotans was entitled to under the agreement. A total of 143 cities and counties had to vote to accept the settlement. As a result, the money is flowing directly to communities that you represent, to use creatively on treatment, mitigation, and prevention. And more opioid settlements are likely in the near future, bringing more money to the state, cities, and counties to address the crisis. The third division of the consumer protection section is the wage theft division. I started the wage theft division in 2019 with the help of a bipartisan bill the legislature passed that gave the Attorney General new authority to investigate and prosecute wage theft. Wage theft occurs when an employer does not pay an employee everything they are owed by law, including things like paying less than the minimum wage, requiring or allowing work off the clock without pay, not paying time and a half for overtime, not paying earned tips, making unlawful deductions from paychecks, not making a final check upon separation of employment, and misclassifying employees as independent contractors when they're actually employees. And to be clear, wage theft doesn't only hurt workers, it also hurts the vast majority of employers and businesses that do right by their workers and play by the rules. An employer that cheats a worker out of their pay also illegally undercuts their competitors who are following the law and paying their workers every dollar that they've earned. In January 2024, my office sued Evergreen Acres, alleging that Evergreen systematically deprived low-wage dairy employees of wages they earn by shaving both regular and overtime hours from workers' paychecks, by failing to pay wages owed at the beginning and end of the workers' employment, and by unlawfully deducting rent for substandard on-site housing that failed to meet the standards of habitability under Minnesota law. In 2022, my office filed a lawsuit against Shipt for misclassifying shoppers as independent contractors. Our belief is that those shoppers are employees and entitled to minimum wage, overtime, and Minnesota employment protections. In 2022, we sued Property Maintenance and Construction for obstructing a Department of Labor and Industry wage investigation and intimidating workers. In 2023, we sued downtown St. Paul's largest landowner for a scheme to avoid paying overtime to security officers using subsidiaries to deprive security work officers of overtime wages owed under Minnesota law. All told, the Wage Theft Division has returned more than $2 million in improperly withheld wages to the pockets of Minnesota workers. Fourth.
Mr. Attorney General, I do have a couple questions on this.
Absolutely.
Some legislation has been recently passed, and we're still trying to work through the details. One of those is the safe and sick time.
Yeah.
And the second is the paid family medical leave. And I'd like to start with the safe and sick time. The Department of Labor and Industry, when they were involved with standing this program up, really didn't, from some of the meetings I was involved with and with work groups where they were brought in, there was some question about, yeah, we're not quite sure how this is gonna work and where things are at. And we've had that program now for about 18 months in the state of Minnesota, and I'm just wondering what your office's interaction has been with the Department of Labor and Industry as those businesses are trying desperately to understand the law, where there's some still some vagueness in that law to get employees what they're rightfully entitled to under the law, but then not maliciously or capriciously file suit against someone who's really trying their very best to comply with the law because they want to keep their employee base.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. We've been working with the agency to make sure that we answer any questions that they have and that we support them as well as we can. In this situation, it really is one in which the agency is the policy and the operational actor, and we kind of step in as counsel. I don't believe, have been called upon to litigate any matter yet. We have not. So at this point, much as I'd love to help you with that question, I think it's better directed to the commissioner.
So, Attorney General Ellison, we have you here today, and that's why I'm asking what your
interaction. Yeah.
You're talking about protecting the workers' rights, and that's a worker right under Minnesota law right now. I'm just wondering, you know, where we're at, if there's
right.
Prosecution on that.
Yeah, and so the thing is, the attorney-client relationship is which is really what we're talking about right now. It really is the agency that is running the show on the implementation of this law. We stand by as legal counsel. Some things we initiate. We We sue on wage theft. Sometimes they do too. And they'll turn their cases over to us if they end up in litigation. But if the matter's not in litigation, the truth is, Mr. Chairman, we may not know the inner workings of how that law is being implemented. And that goes for every agency, right? So that's just sort of the arrangement. I do appreciate your question. I think it is a good question. All I'm saying, Mr. Chairman, is that I'm not the best person to answer it.
Another same kind of idea on another topic, and I'm stepping back just a couple of slides on here. I'm just curious what your office, let me set this up. The Commerce Committee has jurisdiction over real estate insurance, appraisal, securities in different areas. And one area that we're seeing at least some television ads and promotion for consumer benefit is deed theft, right? People didn't know that someone went in and scammed that, or there are erroneous liens that are being filed against someone's home, which really goes back to the whole issue of identity theft.
Yeah.
Can you talk about how prevalent that is in Minnesota and what your agency's interaction has been with Minnesotans on that topic?
Mr. Chairman, it's a serious problem. We've talked about it in our office quite a bit. We've had meetings on how to attack it. To be honest with you, I didn't come prepared to give a full report, but I could. If you were to, I could supplement the record, go back to my staff who are working on this matter and share it with you. I don't know. Do you have any, Jessica, any thoughts on this matter?
Attorney Whitney.
Yeah, so it's a growing problem, but it's not big. I mean, I feel like it's one that's getting a lot of attention, which is great because it's an important problem. It's people's homes. It's what they own the most of. But it is not as prevalent as I think some of those commercials products might suggest, or at least we haven't seen it complaint driven and we haven't seen it yet out in actual Minnesota. I think it's moving our way. I think you see it bigger on the coasts, right? Like much things move our way and we tend to be very trusting. But it's definitely something we're looking at. It is tied to the identity theft aspect. Again, we're looking at it, but it's not as prevalent, I think, as those suggest here yet, and we need to stay on top of it and keep on top of it. Education is important. We need to look at things we can do to prevent it and what might stop folks from just willy-nilly filing liens on people's properties, et cetera. And it's something we as states' attorneys general are talking about amongst ourselves. Again, bipartisan group of states are looking at it.
So. And just to follow, go ahead.
If I may say so. There are things that we have contemplated and are working on now, perhaps giving guidance. We do give consumer alerts. There are things we've thought about to try to resolve this issue. And so, I mean, I just want you to know, Mr. Chairman, that if you'd like to get a solid briefing on this particular question, it's available and we can make ourselves ready for you to do that.
Mr. Attorney General, I think that I haven't talked to lead her on this, and this is a big day in the state of Minnesota for a lot of reasons, but as a result of the outcome of today, it could be co-chairs, and I would invite you to try to get some time to talk to us about it, because I think that is something that is going to be, as the Deputy Attorney said, moving from the coasts here, and the quicker we can get on top of that and protect Minnesotans would be better. And I would also ask, although it's anecdotal right now from what I'm gathering, do you have a demographic that is being targeted or that you're starting to see in your assemblance of data that are being disproportionately affected by this?
It would be the older individuals, older Minnesotans, people that own their home outright usually is what they're going after. So that's obviously generally going to be someone older. I was trying to even think if we'd had direct complaints in our office the last year so we could let you know numbers, but I don't even know if we've actually had a direct complaint in our office. What we've seen are, we've been looking at sort of scams to, again, strip equity. you guys, the Commerce Committee last year passed a good law on a similar thing with a realtor scam that encumbered the home for 40 years. But I can't remember if we've actually had this deed complaint yet, these false deeds and false encumbrances on the home. But I will get that back to you. But it is, again, on the coast what we've seen and what we're talking with other states, it's older homeowners.
And thank you for that. And again, because those records are public records, it is easy for someone to be able to go in and to comb those records. And it's also many counties are starting to put some of that stuff available online, so you don't even have to leave the comfort of your home to begin perpetrating that kind of a fraud. Other questions at this time? Thank you, Mr. Attorney General. I'll have you proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The fourth division is the Antitrust Division. Now, the Antitrust Division supports healthy competition and fair markets by enforcing state and federal antitrust laws. Antitrust violations fall into three broad categories. Agreements not to compete, which means that companies agree to do things like raise prices, reduce supply, or keep employee wages down as a way of limiting competition. Anti-competitive mergers are acquisitions between companies that previously competed with each other, or a merger that makes it harder for other companies to compete. Monopoly abuse, where a dominant company using its size to make it harder for competitors to get customers, supplies, or labor. Minnesota's agricultural sector is vital to the economy and the physical health of our state, and unfortunately, agriculture is one of the areas most prone to anti-competitive corporate action. Recently, alongside the state of Illinois, the Federal Trade Commission, I sued the agricultural equipment manufacturer John Deere Company, also known as John Deere, over its use of unfair practices that have driven up equipment repair costs for farmers while also depriving farmers of the ability to make timely repairs on critical farming equipment, including tractors. In addition, in 2023, Minnesota led a bipartisan coalition of states in a lawsuit against a company called AgriStats for organizing and managing anti-competitive information exchanges among broiler chicken, pork, and turkey processors. The lawsuit alleges that AgriStats' actions resulted in higher prices for consumers. We've also joined with the federal government and a bipartisan coalition of 38 states to address Google's anti-competitive and monopolistic practices. And last year, a federal judge agreed with us that Google is a monopoly. I continue to look for ways to use antitrust and consumer protection laws to address inequities for consumers and to help lower prices for everybody. Next, we move on to the Civil Rights Division. The Civil Rights Division works to protect tenants, home purchasers, and consumers in the marketplace that are targeted or disproportionately harmed by discrimination and fraud on the basis of race, religion, age, and other protected classes. In 2022, we took on a hedge fund-owned Havenbrook Homes, one of the largest landlords in the state, who at the time had over 600 rental units, mostly single-family homes, in cities and suburbs across the metro. Havenbrook severely and systematically understaffed and under-resourced the upkeep of those properties, leading to truly appalling conditions. Tenants often and repeatedly reported no heat, backed up sewer systems, doors and windows that didn't close, mold, and even live wild animals in the home. That's illegal. On top of all of that, Havenbrook promised 24/7 around-the-clock same-day service for emergency repairs, but in reality, they just ignore urgent repair requests and make shoddy repairs if they bother to show up at all, which is also illegal. We took them to court, and last year, we won $2.2 million settlement for current and former Havenbrook tenants, and we got Havenbrook out of Minnesota for good, and our communities are all better for it. The division has returned $239,000 to 8 homeowners who were caught in an alleged foreclosure rescue scam, as well as getting refunds totaling $25,000 to consumers who were promised legal immigration assistance and never received it. Moving on, we have the Charities Division, which serves a number
General
of important...
Wilson, we do have three questions that
sure,
have popped up. We're
absolutely.
Going to Representative Heintzman, followed by Representative Finke, and then Representative Hewitt. Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Attorney General. I am going to go backwards. I apologize. I was kind of waiting for my question to maybe be answered, but I did check through the presentation, and it doesn't appear to be covered. So I just wanted to make sure that I covered a concern a constituent had as they were the victim of a fraud scheme and fell victim to a very significant, unfortunately, very significant action that resulted in over $1 million lost. I just wanted to see if, as we were talking about the hotline.
Yeah.
And folks are contacting your office. What kind of expectation they can have that the AG's office can not only record their loss, but also potentially recover that loss. I think most of these things originate outside of the state of Minnesota. I think in this case, it was originating overseas. And there was a lot of folks involved, but to this date, there has been no resolution. So is the hotline more so just to inform, or is there actually any hope for people who are in this situation where they may have lost their life savings?
Attorney General Ellison.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman and Representative Heintzman, thank you for the question. I can tell you that the point of our consumer action group is to answer questions, but also take in cases and try to resolve them. We do quite a lot of that, as I noted. I don't want to submit to you that we can solve every problem. Scammers get away with it sometimes. If we can't find people, if we can't track them down, it makes it tough. But the Consumer Action Group brings back a lot of money to Minnesotans. And so I would say that they are informative, but they also accept cases in, they resolve them before pre-litigation, and sometimes they will present, if we get, you know, a number of frequent flyer fraudsters, we'll present them to the Consumer Protection Group, who will sue out the cases. Does that answer your question, Representative?
Representative Heintzman, follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to some extent, yes. Is there a statistic? Is there any data to give us a better idea on the committee how frequently the Attorney General's office is able to recover, say, someone's life savings? Is that happen? You know, 50% of the time, quarter. I'm just wondering. And then also, and I'll just add this in: are there other tools that your office needs to say help in those cases statutorily? Or maybe there's something at the federal level that needs to change when we do have these examples of someone's life savings now gone and it's an overseas scam and we're trying to get at, you know, some other foreign entity, government, whatever it may be.
Attorney General Ellison.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative Heintzman. So we have had some substantial computer upgrades, which gives us more data, but at this point, I don't think we track whether or not that we were able to return the person's life savings or not. We track whether they were able to make a recovery. And I don't know. Do you know what the other numbers on that? We can bring you back the numbers on the number of cases we get and the number of cases we're able to recover. I just don't have that data in front of me right now, Representative Heisen. But I think it may well be available. I just didn't have it today.
Representative Heinz, filed?
No, Mr. Chair. I do hope that we can get a better idea of what the success rate is in those cases. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Finke, followed by Representative Hewitt. Representative Finke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Attorney General and Deputy for being here today. This is an extremely important topic. I have a question that kind of pulls two threads together and brings them to the civil rights piece. One of the things that you said earlier is that we have this millennial generation, 30 to 39, that is falling victim to this most frequently. And I was thinking about this in terms of housing and rental discrimination, right? I was a victim of rental discrimination last summer. It happens all the time. They do it to everyone. It's extremely common in my community. People just don't get things because we are trans and we know it. I talked to Homeline, you know, I explored my options, and it's like, well, you can do a bunch of work and maybe get your $75 back, you know, from your rental deposit, and nothing's going to happen. And I didn't file a complaint. But one of the things that's making me think about is, like, the most common people falling for these, right? I didn't fall for anything. I got scammed. Are millennials, but the you know, what something that we know is that the concentration of wealth in this country is definitely not with millennials, right? I mean, it is over half, maybe up to three quarters of wealth in the United States is concentrated in the baby boomer generation. So I would be curious to know, you know, are these, is this just randomized? They'll go for anybody who is likely to fall victim. Are there number of scams, but the number of dollars different from how these things are working? I'm thinking of Representative Heintzman's question about $1 million scam and how few millennials would be available to lose $1 million. So I'm just really curious about how that ties together, right? Like generationally, but also the availability of wealth to be scammed or how that works and what you're seeing in terms of reporting or that shame-based piece, and then also just like, are the financial rewards of being a scammer targeting millennials worth it, or is it just because I'm not really a millennial, but are more likely to fall for it? Does this question make sense?
Attorney General Ellison, there was a lot of questions in there, so we'll kind of take them one at a time. If you didn't catch all of them, we'll refer back to Representative Finke, but we'll give you a chance to go ahead and get started on the questions.
Yeah. If I may, Mr. Chairman, I just want to tell Representative Heintzman, we have been in touch with Interpol around trying to do scam tracing in various countries in the world and work with a group called the National Association of Attorneys General to try to work on those international scams. And we work with our local FBI chapter and groups like that. So just wanted to know. Thank you. Absolutely, the scammers are making money. And think about it. Think about this. I'm a prince from some faraway country, and I have $1 bazillion in an account. I just need, you know, your information, and I'll cut you in on 20% of it. Anybody got an email like that? Okay, thank you. So they might send out 10,000 of those and only get two or three of them, but it doesn't cost much of anything to send those out. So nearly all the money they get from anybody is gravy, right? So these scams are lucrative, which is why they do it. It is absolutely the Satchel Paige theory of go where the money is. Now, the millennials may be less wealthy than baby boomers, but they're larger than baby boomers. Now, so I mean, just on volume, they're worthwhile targeting for scams. And the younger you get, even in your 20s, they may not have as much money, but if you can rip $20 off from a whole lot of people, you could end up with a whole lot of money. Now, the big money is with the older people because they own their own homes. They've been working for years. They have pensions. And many are lonely. You know, like I said, romance scams are a thing. And all of this, I love you with all of my heart, and we can be together forever. All I need you to do is send me $5,000. And many of us would be like, how could anybody go for that? Well, you sit alone in that house for long enough, and you might want someone who's willing to talk to you, you know? And this is how these things happen. But it is randomized, and it is lucrative. And if we don't do what we need to do to stop them and fight them, it will get worse. We've seen it. And there is a certain there's a certain migration of these things, as Deputy Whitney has said. Some start on the coast and work their way in. Some start inside and work their way out. And so it is something that we got to be vigilant for all age ranges. And by the way, just because we're talking about people in their 60s and people in their 30s, don't think that people in their 40s and 20s and teens don't get scammed. They do. It's just a matter of what's more frequent. But absolutely, we see these scams in all age ranges, and we see them from fairly sophisticated people. There's the whole thing about, you know, buying like gift card fraud. You know, it's a common thing nowadays. So There are a range of ways that they're coming at you. It could be more, it could be real estate. It could be just cash. It could be, we've seen some very creative fraud efforts. And would you supplement it all, Deputy?
Deputy Whitney.
Yeah, I think you hit that on the head in the sense that there are folks that literally their whole job in different countries is they go in day to day and they just scam. They just send out emails. And that's cheap for them. They're getting paid by a bigger boss and they'll just proliferate. Emails, text messages are really common now, social media being the most common. And so that hits, I think, that millennial generation. Then for the folks that lose their life savings, they can be especially specifically targeted. They can do that. You know, people used to look up funerals and then go rob your house, right? Like they can look all that stuff online because everything's up online and really target you. And the AI technology is scary. Like I've been to presentations, they need one word from someone and then your whole voice, they've got your whole voice, right? The sort of deep fake, the pictures they can make of you, the videos they can send you are incredible. And when they're looking at $1 million, they will spend a lot of time to do that. So there's that. I wanted to address the portion of your question about you not filing a complaint. You should totally file a complaint because rentals, especially if you have problems with rentals, it's hard for us, our office, to see into rentals. Like we can look at the larger mortgage industry because of their tight regulations and the ability to go into that data. But the individual rental interaction on face-to-face, we just don't see it. So we need people to tell us. We're getting out there. We're going to schools these days. We just launched a big senior push for getting seniors educated, not only to educate them, but to let them know to come to us to file complaints. Back to the $1 million constituent that's lost their life savings. That is probably gone overseas. There are a couple ways to address it. Like we do try and work with the international folks because that's the best way to do it. If you're looking at legislative fixes, we can utterly talk. There are some ideas. I don't know how they lost their money. I guess maybe perhaps those Bitcoin ATMs you see at maybe proliferating in your districts, and you might see them at gas stations or whatever. Those are being used even more than gift cards these days to perpetrate scams, and the money's just gone. And I know some of our sister states are looking at them, and we've been talking about ways you can do that. And then AARP came to us with this idea of a consumer fund for cases like that, where you fill it with some of the money that sometimes we get penalties in addition to restitution in our cases, and you take some of that penalty money and create this fund that people can then, that our office can then persecute someone like that. It would be a default judgment because they'd never show up because they're probably outside the country. And then we could use that fund to get some of that money back. So I would ask you to look into that bill. But also, if you want to talk about how that money gets transferred, that's another point. It's an arms race. Like we kind of cracked down on like Western unions and stuff used to be the way to do it, and that got cracked down. And then gift cards, and that got cracked down between merchants and legislative efforts and education. Now it's been Bitcoin and other ways to do it. So happy to have that discussion and honestly talk to you about your individual constituent and see what we can do.
Representative Finke, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just very quickly, I appreciate the detail. That's really important to me to understand how these are working and how randomized and targeted. I'll just follow up and say it was a terrible experience last summer. I ended up stretching a little bit more than I perhaps wanted to and bought a home because I don't want to have to deal with it anymore. Been a homeowner for 6 weeks. I'd say I've gotten 10 million spam calls since then, right? Like, I don't know why. I don't know who those people are. I don't know why they're calling me. But I assume it's because I bought a house. There's nothing else changed. So I just feel like if it's not one thing, it's another. Obviously, you are, you know, pushing the boulder up the hill trying to keep up with people who are doing all they do is scam, right? Like, they have nothing but time to figure out how to be a pain. But it's a real pain. So let's figure out how to get those calls out here, too.
Attorney General Ellison.
Thank you. So the Charities Division.
I'm sorry. I thought maybe you wanted to talk about that. The list of questioners is we fell in the sweet spot in the conversation today, I think, if you will. Representative Hewitt followed by Representative Kreisha.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and General. I've had a problem in my district for about 4 years. It was a builder gone bad. It involves title companies, it involves realtors, it involves deed. And my concern is, number one, I'm expecting a call any moment now from the constituent that calls me daily. Seniors seem to have a lot of time on their hand to follow up on these, where I feel that this particular constituent or this pool of seniors that we're taking advantage of by a builder gone bad, I don't think all builders do this or all realtors do this, but they contacted your office, they contacted Commerce, they contacted Deed, and I'm worried we have silos within our own departments here at the state that are, do you have a system that makes sure that all of you are working on the same subject, or is there silos and that this somehow bubbles out together? I feel that on this journey I've been with her that we're still not getting anywhere. It's about to go on the Star and Tribune like this week or next. And I have concerns that there's no, well, I don't want to say there's no follow-up, because when she calls your office, she does get, we can't comment on an ongoing investigation. But is there any way that somebody that's personally involved with it, I get why I can't be told, but that there's a Gantt chart that says, yep, the investigation is at this phase, or we're willing to drop the investigation. I get frustrated with that part, and then also, are there really silos, or am I not seeing something here? Thank you, sir.
Attorney General Ellison.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I would need to know the name, which I don't want you to speak out loud, to know what, and then I'd have to go to the lawyers and the investigators on the file and say, where are we at on that? But I can assure you that if the complaint has been made, somebody's working on it. I just need to know a little bit more about it to even give you an idea of where we are in the process. A lot of these things are document intensive, and you know we're serving them with discovery demands and taking depositions, things like that. And I just have no idea where we are on this particular matter. In terms of the siloing issue, we do consult with the agencies and work with them. A lot of the times when we get involved with the agencies have worked on a matter, and now they need somebody to sue that matter out, and then that's how we get involved. So it is possible that a particular case could be rumbling around Commerce or Deed, and we really don't know about it yet. If the complaint was made to them and somebody over there is working on it, we might not get it until that case is ready to be sued out. I'll say that we do talk on a regular basis, but they have such a high volume of cases that they're working on, and we have such a high volume we're working on, that there might be some cases that we're both working on and we don't know it. That is possible. I'll also say that we do cooperate pretty well once the case gets to the point of a lawsuit. But before that, it's just hard to know. Often the agencies will contact us when they're being obstructed, and we have to take legal action about some company that is obstructing the investigation. That's really the state of the reality. That's the state of it right there. I can tell you that if we can talk after, we'll be more than happy to give you as much information as the Data Practices Act allows us to share. Certainly I think that I don't see any problem with us telling the victim what's going on. Yeah, so anything that'd be added there?
Deputy Whitney.
Yeah, if it is a case that it's blown up into a bigger case, then it's not just what we would call complaint handling, then we're a little bit more limited in what we can share. We will definitely tell someone if the file is closed, so that your constituent hasn't heard the file is closed, because we believe in letting them know right away. It means it's ongoing. My guess is it means it's evolved into a bigger investigation. And like the Attorney General said, we do meet with like Commerce every other month to go over things that we're seeing and really just have a talk. They have a big caseload. We have a big caseload. We don't always get down to the nitty-gritty, but when we see actors start to rise or we have questions, we're trying to get around those silos. So.
If I may supplement a bit, Representative Hewitt, there are frequent flyers. There have been occasions over the last 7 years that I've been at the AG's office that just names, the same name keeps coming up. So now we know this is a problem. And so we will confer with our agency partners on those things. And the agencies do something different than the AG's office. So for example, DLI can do a site visit. They can go to that meatpacking plant and go in there and start looking around. They're legally authorized to do that. We can't do that. But we can sue them pre-discovery and get into court quicker than DLI. So there are things that they do, there's things that we do, and they do work together, but sometimes the coordination could be better. And that's just a matter of the volume, quite honestly. But we'd love to follow up with you on that matter.
Representative, you had a follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm done.
I will just, Representative Hewitt, for your question, it is very possible within the jurisdiction of this committee that a complaint could come in that could touch multiple departments. For example, as you and I both being involved in the real estate industry know that we have the Human Rights Act that we have to abide by. We also have licensure violations that could be in both of those camps. So there could be multiple activities that are happening, and ultimately the Attorney General's office could be involved. And that is one of the reasons why I was very big, and I know Representative Stevenson isn't here today, but he and I both share the concern of moving the Fraud Bureau investigation out of the Department of Commerce and putting it over to the BCA, because now you have two different hands that are involved in this. When it was centralized and it was working extremely well in that agency, where you have the licensure related issues and the enforcement related issues in the same department, in the same agency. So to your point, I think you're almost making the case for why we should keep the Fraud Bureau investigation in the Department of Commerce, because two different directions, two different agencies on the same matter. Representative Elkins, I've got two other folks before I get to you on this. And again, we want to wrap by about 9:25, 9:30 this morning for some other meetings that are going to be taking place here. I think what we'll do is we'll grab these three questions. Attorney General Ellison, we'll let you finish with the charity, and then we'll come back for the balance of the time for any other questions. We'll take the ones that are on the list right now, have you finish up, and then, again, questions if there are any that are remaining. Representative Reimer, followed by Representative Van Binsberg, and we'll follow. Representative Reimer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Attorney General, for taking the time today. My question is, when you talked about kind of anti-competitive, monopolistic entities and how they hurt our communities and hurt the consumer, you know, I talked to a constituent yesterday in particular about this tribal compact with cannabis distribution, and it seems like a lot of these vendors who were given first access or just had the pretense that they would have opportunity to open up a small business in that regard had the rug pulled on them by this tribal compact. And my question for you, talking about reducing competition, encouraging monopolies, have you looked into maybe like the legality of that or considered, I don't know, either filing suit or looking into, on behalf of our small businesses who expected to have a location, just the constitutionality, the legality of this tribal compact that we're hearing about?
Attorney General Ellison.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for raising that. At this point, I don't know if I received complaints about that, but here's what I think that I would ask you to do. Tell some of those small business people to make a complaint to us. We certainly will dig into it. We certainly will investigate and find out whether or not there's any violations of our antitrust laws, because we firmly believe in fair competition, and we've because of your assistance as the legislature, we've increased our antitrust group. We have a little bit more capacity than we used to have, and we'd be more than happy to investigate that matter.
Representative Reimer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Attorney General Keith Ellison. That's great to hear. It's encouraging, and I'm sure you'll be receiving a couple more complaints in the coming weeks here.
All right. Thank you.
We'll go to Representative Vinsbergen, and then followed by Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Attorney General, thank you for being here today. Appreciate your time and candor.
Thank you.
My question is, you were talking about, what was the name of the company that you sued that had the animals in the building?
Oh, Havenbrook Homes.
Okay. And I guess it was about a $2 million settlement? something like that?
Mr. Chairman,
Attorney General.
I think it's 2.2 million is what I remember, yeah.
And I'm assuming that player's been a bad actor kind of historically.
Folks, through the chair, please. Our Attorney General Ellison.
Mr. Chairman, yeah, they've been a bad actor in a lot of different places and spaces. Yeah.
So,
Representative Embersberg,
Mr. Chair. The settlement, how does that get dispersed? And, you know, who are the beneficiaries? And I'm just curious how that worked.
Attorney General Ellison.
Mr. Chair, so thank you for asking that. We have staff at the AG's office who will distribute restitution. And, you know, we have a group of, I mean, it is hard work. It's harder than you might guess to identify all these victims, cut checks for all of them in the proper amount, and then get them out there. But that's the process that we have. Actually, Jessica might be a little closer to the process than I am.
Deputy Whitney.
Yes, so for Havenbrook especially, and generally on our restitution claims, we have a list of people impacted, and then we send them out communication. We try and make contact with them, and between our data, and then we have them fill out forms. They let us know how much they've lost. They provide documentation to prove that loss, plus we've got documentation that we've gotten on the loss to come at an amount that tries to fully restitute them. If we don't have full restitution, we do it per, you know, we try and make it even and equal throughout. And the legislative auditor checks all of our restitution when, you know, they do audits every couple of years. They especially dig into our cases to make sure we're not just willy-nilly giving away money. But we're very careful. Sometimes we'll hire a third-party administrator if the claim is big enough and it would overwhelm our staff. And if we're talking tens of thousands of people, we might hire a third party to help us do that. But a lot of it we'll do internally.
Representative Vinsberg, in follow-up.
So you don't... Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we don't, on that particular case, do you know roughly went back to the individuals that were part of that?
Deputy Whitney.
So it's still ongoing. Our goal is to get rid of, to give individuals the whole 2.2 million. We thought that, I mean, that was a case where we believe that was close to full restitution, so we're trying to give it all out. If we can't find people, which sometimes happens, especially some of consumers in some of these housing cases, they're very transient. And if we can't track them down, the money can either go to unclaimed property if we've cut a check, or if we can't even track them down to cut a check, it will come back to the general fund.
And Representative Elkins.
Mr. Chair, could I add one thing important about this?
Sir, Attorney General, go ahead.
Just for everybody's awareness, the Attorney General's office doesn't keep a penny in the money that we get for Minnesotans or the state of Minnesota. It is either ultimately going to the general fund, or it could go to, as you say, unclaimed property, or it will go to one of the funds that you have legislatively established, for example, the ORAC and the opioid. So we might go sue folks and get money from them, but ultimately it's going to individuals or it's coming back to the general fund.
Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I foolishly volunteered to serve on the Fraud Prevention and Oversight Committee, which has resulted in me spending most of my Sundays reading OLA reports. But out of all of this work, I'm seeing kind of a pattern. I've kind of organized the work that needs to be done into kind of four slices. There's the legislative function, that's us. At the other end of the continuum, there's the prosecutorial function, which is clearly you. In the middle, there's the administrative function that clearly lies with the agencies. The area that seems to be the murkiest is the investigative function, which seems to be variously parceled out among the agencies themselves. Some of them have inspectors general, some of them don't. The BCA, and then your staff clearly does some investigative work itself. I'm wondering if you have given thought to this, you know, same question, and have thoughts on what would be the best, if there is even a consistent best way to handle the investigative function, because I think we're seeing some of the frustration and some of the other members' questions about who does a consumer go to when they have questions about the status of an investigation? I'm just wondering, big picture, have you given this some thought? And would you have some recommendations for the fraud committee on what would be the best way to approach improving and rendering the investigative function more consistent?
Attorney General Ellison.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Elkins, this is such an important question. I'm a little reluctant to just give you my off-the-cuff answer. It is critically important. Certainly the BCA has an important role to play, but generally the BCA is managing things that are criminal in nature. There's a whole lot of fraud violations of consumer fraud statutes that aren't crimes and yet are illegal but are civil. And so we need to deal with both. And so I would say it would not be, in my opinion, a waste of time to sit and think about how do we make sure that we are investigating fraud. Because at the end of the day, everybody who's ever seen Law and Order knows that if you don't have an investigation, you don't really have a prosecution. We've got to be working together in that way. We have our own staff, but at the same time, we rely on our partners to do a lot of this work. So I would say that off the cuff, I think that I don't know if there's a way to simply centralize all the investigation, but I do think, and this is something that I think was mentioned before, that there may be some ways to break down some silos, share information about frequent bad actors, and I think that would be a good use of our time to dig into how do we make sure these things get investigated, because I actually believe that investigation may be more critical to solving these problems than even ultimate consequence and punishment. Because if there is very little chance that I'm going to get caught, who cares if whoever does get caught gets a lot of time, right? That's not going to be me. People who do this stuff do not think they're going to get caught. So the fact that somebody who wasn't as slick and as quick as them ultimately gets a really hard consequence isn't a deterrent to them. What is a deterrent to them is if you increase the likelihood that you're going to get caught. Now you're talking about pushing down on bad behavior. And so I guess my answer is let's give this excellent question the time that it really deserves. I'd be more than happy to have staff part of any group to just talk about how we make sure all these matters are investigated properly so that your average fraudster's gonna say, you know, it's just they got a lot of people looking for you, man. That's not a good place to try to steal money from.
Representative Elkins, quick follow-up.
Mr. Chair, just a couple of years ago, House Research did a really good research synthesis on what deters crime. And it's exactly as the Attorney General is telling us, what deters crime is a perception that you're likely to get caught. The length of the sentence, does nothing really. It's the main thing the criminal is considering is what is the likelihood I'm going to get caught.
Very good, Attorney General Ellison. We'll give you a chance to briefly overview the Chair's division, and then there may be. I know that Representative Hur and I, as the lead in the chair, have just a couple of quick follow-ups with you. So we'll go ahead and have you finish your presentation.
With your indulgence, Mr. Chair, I'm just going to say very quickly that the Attorney General's office is not simply a law enforcer in charities. We oversee and regulate charities, charitable trusts, other nonprofits active in Minnesota. We enforce state charitable solicitation, charitable trust, nonprofit laws, maintaining public registry of charities, charitable trusts, and professional fundraisers that operate in our state. The number is voluminous, more than 13,000. Soliciting charitable organizations in fiscal year 2023, 2,400 charitable trusts, more than 300 professional fundraisers. These charitable organizations held more than $906 billion in assets and have more than $410 billion in revenue. And I will say that our main, just so the committee's aware, our enforcement tools are civil in nature. If there's a crime, we will refer that to one of the local county attorneys. They may ask us to prosecute it out. Generally, it is their responsibility at the local level. And Mr. Chairman, I know you wanted me to stop there, but I think it would be incomplete if I didn't mention that we do residential utilities division as well. And the reason I want to mention that, Mr. Chairman, is that every single person in this room, nearly everybody in Minnesota, pays residential utility bills. And it's our responsibility at the Attorney General's office to represent the interests of residential and small business utility consumers, the ratepayers. And so we will be found at the Public Utilities Commission arguing that the against the rate increase, generally speaking. And I just wanted everyone to know that because it is the most important, least interesting thing you ever heard of in our office. Most people think utility rate issues are boring. They're right. But boy, do they ever matter, because everybody pays these bills. And, you know, if you want to wonder how important they are, let me just take you back a few years ago when there was that climactic spike in Texas, which drove everybody's utility rates sky high. And we had to fight through that to protect Minnesota consumers. So I only mention that because I just think that it's last, but it's really not least when it comes to the importance of the consumer. And people on a fixed income absolutely need us fighting for them. And we do that work with a lot of pride. And I think I can wrap up right there, Mr. Chairman. And I have a few more pages, but I think that I certainly can submit those for the record. And I'll just wrap up by saying that it's a great honor to be in front of you to talk about these really important issues. And I'll conclude right there with the thanks of the committee and you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. And if time permits, we'll certainly have you back. There are some other things that you were going to do, some investigation.
Oh, yeah, we got some research. Well. We got some projects.
We have 3 minutes. We have 3 questions. Representative Cha, Representative Hur, and then myself. Representative Cha.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Attorney General, for being here. Yeah, you know, I just want to commend your work, you know, the Attorney General's office work, especially on 3M settlement. You know, that was a vital, a piece of settlement for the city of Woodbury, as you know, with the PFAS situation. And, you know, with that settlement money, we are putting together a $300 million water treatment plant that went in last year. And so, you know, I want to thank the Attorney General's office for the great work that they continue to do. And, taking care of critical infrastructure for the city of Woodbury, and so I appreciate that. Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Representative Chapp. Representative Hur.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I also just wanted to extend my gratitude to Attorney General Ellison and Deputy for being here today. I think that just from my own anecdotal perception is that with the technology development, that I think that scamming has become easier and easier, which means we need more and more of our residents, and we appreciate that you are our partner in this work. And I did just want to put a little quick plug out that Representative Liz Lee does have a bill to look at settlements and how to create a fund so that all the money just doesn't go to a general fund, but it can be put in a specific pool so that people who have been impacted by a specific lawsuit can have access to those funds. And it does have bipartisan support. So for those who might have talked about that today, who you're interested, you should probably maybe have a conversation with her about that bill, and hopefully we'll have a chance to hear that in this committee.
Mr. Chairman, can I comment on that?
Representative, excuse me, I went back to your days in Congress.
I was there for
Attorney General Ellison.
I just wanted to note, this is particularly important when the defendant is insolvent. There are cases where the defendant has ripped off a bunch of people, but the money has gone here, there, and everywhere, and so we don't have any restitution to restitute. So that's all I want to say.
Mr. Attorney General, again, with the thanks to the committee, appreciate your time here today. Two topics that we did not get a chance on my end to talk about, but I'm just going to toss them out there. The first one is there's certainly been a lot of discussion about fraud and things in the media about how they've affected tax dollars in the state of Minnesota. And if time does permit, I'd love to have you come back and talk about what your office is doing, trying to help recover and to prosecute in those situations. There's no secret. The state of Minnesota is facing a deficit right now and different things. And to find ways that we can shore that up as a legislature to prevent those things from happening.
Sure.
And for the committee's benefit, the Secretary of State's office deals with business formation, and some of that is under our committee's jurisdiction. And like there is individual identity theft, there's also business theft that's going on, where businesses are having problems where scamsters are out there opening up accounts in their name and the business, and they're being levied for. And the folks in the actors are completely out of town. So there certainly is no lack of fraud out there. So we do thank everyone in the committee for their questions today. And Deputy Whitney, thank you. And Attorney General Ellison, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
No more business for the committee today. We are adjourned.